Scottish fans. Today, I am so excited because we have a hacker. Oh my God, a hacker. I always wanted to have a hacker. But we have an ethical hacker of Michelle Kahn. And actually, we met in Vegas, of all places, recently at the World Game Protection Conference. And I was blown away by your presentation. It was good and it was actionable. A lot of presentations aren't actionable. Yours was very actionable.
Yeah, I like to entertain people. That's my thing. I don't like to bore people with, technical jargon. I like to show them. And, you know, this way they experience something firsthand. And they realize, you know, how dangerous certain things are, how information can be taken out of context and used by the bad guys. So that's my whole goal, to, you know, get something actionable out of it.
Yeah. And you did some fun stuff with AI and Willie Allison about, you know, changing his face and making it so, you know, people could be fished and stuff like that. That was really, it was good.
And it was easy.
Okay. So Michelle, what is an ethical hacker?
Well, in a nutshell, an ethical hacker is a person who can demonstrate hacking capabilities just like a malicious hacker would, with the goal of protecting the organization or whoever your client is, an individual, and not to actually hack, but to show how hacking can be done, and in that process, unveil some vulnerabilities that can be then patched and corrected.
So how did you at age 5 say, I'm going to grow up and be an ethical hacker? How did you get to give the audience your sort of how you got to be an ethical hacker?
I think I organically grew into the role by being very technical. As a kid, I was always curious on how computers worked. My dad used to get these old computers, well, old now, but pretty latest back then when I was a kid. And I used to like tear them apart and like change stuff in the computer, like put a new hard drive, replace the motherboard. At a very young age, I was exposed to how stuff works. And my curiosity was like, all right, if it works like this, what if I do something else? How does it break? Same thing with software. I was introduced to games and then cheat codes and how to crack a game and how to skip a level and get God mode in some, you know, different levels and stuff like that. So that kind of piqued my interest into breaking stuff in for my own purposes. But I never was malicious with that. So I always tried to think of ways on how to improve this, because then I started building my own websites. And I'm like, what if somebody broke my website and logged in, or my own accounts? And I had a few experiences back and forth with hacking and with people around me who were getting like breached. And I'm like, how do I protect them with the knowledge I have? So I always took this in a very positive way. I said, these are abilities that should be used to protect people instead of harming them, because there were just way too many people misusing them.
So, and you mentioned this a little bit briefly, like you have fun. And so, okay, guys, you're going to go to this LinkedIn page and you're going to see. And what is your address on your LinkedIn page?
So the official address, like the home address that I advertise, is, I believe, 10800 Malibu Drive, which is, if you Google that, look that up, it's Tony Stark's address in Iron Man. So it's fictitious, does not exist. Even the phone number there is a Rickroll phone number. I've had a lot of sales folks call me on that number and then message me. They're like, oh, we got a good laugh. That number isn't really yours. Same thing with almost everything that's out there that doesn't need to be there, like date of birth. As you've seen, it's April 1st. I got a lot of birthday wishes this April from people. And I'm like, wow, why would I put my date of birth in social media? But it's just an example to show people you don't need to put true information out there. And these companies don't need your information, but they ask for it anyways. And we give it anyways. And then it ends up in a breach and then someone else misuses it.
So speaking of breaches, we talked just briefly about the AT&T breach. And you have a friend who is like, I haven't, you know, had AT&T forever. And what did you find?
Yeah, I had a friend who was like, I haven't been an AT&T customer for over 10 years, yet his name was in this latest AT&T breach. Not only was his name there, his phone number and his full unredacted social security number was in it, as well as millions of other people. So that was a pretty big eye-opener for most people, because most breaches will have an email address and a password, or a redacted password, or an encrypted password. And people are like, yeah, you know, whatever, we've changed our passwords, and they move on. But with this one, you can't really change your social security number. You can't easily change your home address. Your phone number also usually remains the same. And these are things that people can exploit, do ID theft, identity theft with this. And yeah, it's almost impossible to change it or even protect yourself against something like this.
And I will put in the show notes att.pentester.com, and you guys can all go and check, because I'm going to go and check, because I haven't had AT&T in forever. But based on the story, like, I'm a little concerned. So, okay, in the hacking world, is this like, do you guys like go, okay, who's getting fired for this? Like, was it a nation state? Was like someone at AT&T just sleeping on the job? Like, what is your assessment of that, since it is a really big hack?
In most cases, including this one, it's a third party that gets hacked. So companies like AT&T, or I won't just throw AT&T under the bus. I would throw every organization under the bus at this point, because almost all of them are not paying attention to security. With this hack and with others, it's a third party that gets hacked because they have too much access to their data. And then when they get hacked, all, you know, AT&T's data in this case was leaked. And this may have been slightly older data. This was like a 2019 breach, which was became public right now. But still, you know, like I said, addresses and social security numbers don't change in decades even. So it's all of the above. Everyone's to blame here, including the organizations for not safeguarding their data properly, not putting in all the security controls that everyone talks about. And, you know, when breaches like this happen, then end users are affected. The company still, you know, operates regularly, because in most cases, like with telecom providers, they have a monopoly. So we as consumers don't really have much of a choice but to, you know, just move on and like not do anything about it. It's sad, but that's how it goes mostly.
You do bounty work, but you told me before you never actually apply for it. Is it just like fun for you?
It is. It's a challenge for me. So I like challenges. I'm good at open source intelligence. I know that. I've been doing it for a good part of 20 years now. And I've always done it to help people in need, and people who are victims of hacking, of stalkers, of sextortion, those type of things. It's becoming more and more common now. So I try my best to use my abilities to help people. And I try to keep my skills fresh. So yeah, if I see something public, like a bounty on someone who's wanted, I'll often demo that in my open source intelligence class, or just, you know, just for fun. I'll be like, let's see if I can find this person. He's either a sex offender or some criminal or a missing person for that case. I'm like, all right, let me see what I can do. And oftentimes there is a bounty on certain people's head, a couple of $1,000 or whatnot. And if I do find them, I do put a tip in their tip line. I email them anonymously, but I never put in my own name in it. Multiple reasons. I mean, the primary reason is because I don't want my name in any database, any government database or some private database, where that will eventually get leaked, and it's not worth a couple of $1,000 for me to be exposed that way. But also, if somebody privately asks me for a favor, they're a victim of stalking or whatever, I would never take money in that case, because my ethics won't allow it, and it would just muddy the waters in my head, saying, am I doing this to help people, or am I doing this for money? So in my opinion, there's a time and place to make money, to do business, and then there's a time and place to help people out. And I kind of divide the two up in my head.
So I'm going to admit, I'm watching a cheesy TV show called Tracker. Have you heard of Tracker?
I have not.
Okay, so it's the guy from... a very popular TV show, the actor, I can't think of his name, but he calls himself a bounty hunter, and he's got a hacker in the show. Like it's totally cheesy, but when he introduces himself, he says, "I'm a bounty hunter." And people are like, "What?" And, you know, I don't know. I'm not recommending it. It's like, you know, when I need something totally brainless, I will go and watch Tracker, but he's got the hacker, he's got the people helping him, and it's all for good. So,
I'll watch it.
Yeah. So, we also talked before, you do a lot of going to trainings, and one that you always said you go to is the Wild West Hacking Fest. What do you like about that?
Yeah, I go to a lot of these conferences, cybersecurity conferences, and I mostly go to network, to meet new people, to learn something new, to just expand my knowledge. And with this particular one, Wild West Hacking Fest, which is in South Dakota every year in Deadwood, it's fun because it's a closer knit community. Everyone's approachable. That is the differentiator there. And everyone kind of leaves their egos at home and comes there to learn, to network, to just chat with people. And I go to a lot of these conferences where the speakers, where you go and try to talk to them and they're not approachable. They come in and they fly out an hour after their talk, or there's just too many people around them. At Wild West Hacking Fest, it's like it's in the middle of nowhere. And it's like you can't really go anywhere out. And it's just the people are nice and very friendly. So I would highly advise anyone who's in the InfoSec field and they want to make more contacts, go to conferences like these versus some of the really large vendor conferences where no one has time for you.
Yeah. So what other, do you have any other conferences that you like? Or maybe I've always been scared. What's the one where people just try and hack each other all the time?
That's DEF CON.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
It's overhyped. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of DEF CON. I do go occasionally. I've spoken at DEF CON in the past. But you'll find all sorts of people. My experiences have been mixed at conferences like these. They're so big. They're like, you know, 25,000 people and stuff. So you'll get some crowd that's egotistic, a lot of hacker type mentality. People think they're, you know, great and they'll be kids. But you'll also get some professionals who've been in the industry for a while. So it's kind of a mixed bag. It really depends on where you end up. And then, you know, right before the DEF CON conference, there's Black Hat, which is also pretty popular. That's mostly for vendors. I do go to that one occasionally because in my job as a CISO, I do have to know about vendors, the latest and greatest technology that's out there. So I do need to level up my skill set on the product side of things. So I do attend those as well.
Okay, so you just mentioned something, CISO. Like, you know, did we have CISOs 20 years ago? No. Did we?
No, I don't believe so. If we did, it wasn't that common.
Yeah. So we had CIOs. And then when did CISO kind of be, you know, mandatory? And it's not even mandatory for everyone, but it should be mandatory. Right. When did that change take place?
I think in the last decade or so, it became very popular. And when a lot of these breaches started becoming normalized, so almost every day there's a breach now, people are getting immune to it. And now people are questioning. They're like, why aren't organizations taking care of security? I guess the primary issue was nobody was responsible for security. So CISO's role is a person who's responsible for managing the security risk inside an organization. And the IT director can't do it. The CIO has different responsibilities for technology. The CTO is similar. They all have different roles and responsibilities. And security was just a subset of those. That's why it was never given a serious thought. So in the past, I want to say 10 to 15 years, this field has become quite popular and it's become a dedicated role. Now organizations are realizing, we need a CISO on staff if we need to get in ahead of these breaches. Otherwise, this is never going to stop.
And you've written a book about this, haven't you?
I have. It's called the Phantom CISO, and that's kind of that progression to a CISO, because as I said, last decade or so, those roles were kind of merged and mixed into IT directors, network directors, and those folks were playing the role of like a hybrid CISO. So I call them the Phantom CISO. They kind of had the responsibilities, but they weren't really a true CISO. So they're the Phantom CISO. So the book is mostly around how to upskill yourself and do a self-gap analysis from a technical and a business perspective, develop your soft skills to be an effective cybersecurity leader, develop some of the technical know-how to do your job right. So it's a leadership book on how to effectively manage cybersecurity in an organization and how to climb up the ladder and be at that top of that pyramid, which I consider a CISO to be in.
Okay, so we've also talked about docs and swatting, and those are big things. So give the audience your like views on docs and swatting, because like swatting, you know, that's in our vernacular these days, and it's awful.
Yeah, I think from all of the things within the cybersecurity realm or within the hacking realm that scares me the most is swatting. So swatting is when someone calls the SWAT team on your home address. So if someone knows your home address, all they need to do is just pick up the phone and call the SWAT team, maybe spoof that number. Right now they're doing it with the AI. They're mimicking, cloning someone else's voice and calling law enforcement and saying, hey, this person's about to whatever, commit a crime, or I just killed everyone in my house and I'm going to kill everyone else, and you better get over here. So the SWAT team comes to your home with, you know, fully armed, and these criminals, you know, they hope that they're going to make a mistake and accidentally shoot you or whatever, and just cause terrorism, essentially domestic terrorism. So that's what's happening nowadays, and law enforcement has to respond because they've been called. So it's like you can't even stop it. So that's what is my biggest fear, swatting. And then, you know, with swatting, there's other, you know, lower level things like, you know, calling someone at your house, like pizza delivery, delivering, you know, 10, 20, you know, pizzas at different times, just being annoying, or delivering mail, random mail to your house, or junk mail, or bricking is another service where somebody hires someone online at a forum and says, hey, I'll pay you $50, go throw a brick at this person's house. All because, you know, they had some, you know, animosity against you online, maybe in a game or a forum, or you said something wrong on social media. The person looked you up online, and through all these people search websites, they found your home address. And now crime as a service exists, where they can throw bricks at your house. Or recently I posted about this poop service, what is it, shitpost.com. And there's so many of these nonsense services out there where it makes it so easy. Just pay online and have some, you know, something delivered to your house. So it's hard to combat.
I had a friend in high school. She was a little bit older than me. And remember, I don't know, you're younger than me, but remember the, like, you get 12 records for a penny, and then she used to do that to people. I thought it was awful. And she's like, oh, they can cancel. And she'd send them terrible records. Like, she, you know, that just seems so ridiculous now compared to like crime as a service.
Mm-hmm.
But
absolutely.
Back then we thought it was awful.
Yeah. And back then there weren't enough options. So now technology has advanced. There's, you know, more underground forums to do this. They're more organized, these online criminals, and the mailing system is better now. There's more technology to keep them anonymous, like VPNs and, you know, the dark web. And so it's just made it much easier to get away with it nowadays.
Well, and now everyone's talking about AI and how AI is going to, you know, even more so. So what are your thoughts on AI and, say, you know, swatting?
Yeah, it's AI has made all these things a little bit more worse, because before swatting was like, oh, maybe I can recognize the person's voice. Well, now through AI voice cloning, as you saw in my presentation, it took me about a few minutes to clone that person's voice. And all I needed was a sample of about 15 seconds, 20 seconds, and you can make them say whatever you want. So it's made it more believable, those swatting calls. It's made crime in general more believable, social engineering and vishing, which is voice-based phishing. It's just made those things exponentially more easier and believable for the victim. And then add facial cloning onto that, or deep fakes. Now there's a whole new dimension of crime that exists there, where now people are making deep fakes of mostly women, and they're blackmailing them and saying, hey, if you don't give us, you know, small amounts of money initially, we're going to post your picture. And then they get trapped in that loop of paying these perpetrators more and more cash. It's become a new crime as a service thing, deepfakes.
Well, so which leads me to, like, is the U.S. ahead or behind in like this awfulness of this sort of new crime wave?
Way behind, in my opinion.
Okay, so who's leading the pack?
So I would say if you go out in other parts of the world, you don't see this stuff like swatting, for example. I have not heard of swatting in, let's say, the Middle East or Europe or Asia in general. It may exist, but it doesn't make the headlines. In the US, it's so common, it makes headlines because people die. And it's part to do with the facilities that are here. It's easier to do. The laws here are quite loose when it comes to privacy, and also the militarization of the police is another issue. Whereas in other countries, it's not that way. In the UK, for example, the police barely have guns. I mean, they have batons mostly. And then swatting is so difficult because you can't find someone's home address as easily as just Googling someone in Europe, in Asia. People are not active on social media in the Middle East as much. So there's not a lot you can do online to piss someone else off. All those various dynamics of culture and geography and laws, privacy laws, make it much more difficult for something like this to be so common that a 13-year-old will just go online and commit crime. So it's much worse in the US than it is everywhere else, in my opinion.
Well, and is there, you know, I have heard, like, during COVID and a lot of the COVID PPP fraud and everything, unemployment insurance fraud was from nation states.
It's the crime in that area is more complicated. So the way it's done nowadays is there's initial access brokers where maybe a nation state or maybe someone else will provide you with that initial access, let's say login details to a portal. And then someone else locally will take those login details because they'll understand the system better, the system of the IRS or insurance claims or retirement funds. And then they'll exploit that process using those credentials, and that could be your social security number or something else. So if, let's say, an AT&T breach happened with social security numbers, whoever did that breach, whether local or international or whoever that was, someone else will now take that same data and push the envelope a little bit further and commit local fraud, a local fraud which only a local would know how to do, like the PPP scams and stuff like that. So it's a combination of all these different levels of hackers that just makes all of this crime even more harder to catch.
So do you have someone that, like, you hold up and you actually know their name, that, like, they're like, if you, okay, say you got doxxed, do you have someone that you would go and go, okay, this is the person who can help me?
I would change houses.
Okay. So that, okay. You bring that up when, I don't know if you followed the whole Twitter debacle with Yoel Roth. He was the trust and safety head, and he actually had to move. He had to move his family.
I say this in all seriousness because it is very difficult to prevent doxing once your information is out there. If my home address is public and I piss off someone online, all they have to do is just call the SWAT team and give my home address. The system is such that they have to come to my house. They have to check. They have to kind of terrorize me in the process, because 20 SWAT team members will show up and their only job is to, you know, neutralize a threat that doesn't exist in this case. So it's very difficult. And how do you stop it? Like, I've heard other podcasts where, you know, a person was swatted like 40 times in a month, which is multiple times in a day, because you pissed someone else off online. So it's difficult. And my solution to this is prevention. I mean, start being more private and have a balance. I'm not saying disappear, but keep your home address extremely private. Keep your phone number only to people who need to know you, a smaller circle. And then, you know, email address, maybe a wider circle. And then public profile like LinkedIn or Twitter, even more people know about that. So create these circles of privacy where only certain people know certain things about you. So for in my case, my phone number, my personal email address, and my home address, these are the three things I protect heavily, because I know these can be exploited and they're extremely difficult to change anywhere. I can take them out from public data brokers, the opt-out processes and stuff, but it's really hard to prevent something like this. So if something, you know, happens like this to me, yeah, I want to say I'll be screwed temporarily, but it's going to be very difficult to prevent it then moving forward.
So that's interesting, because I kind of like, I'm out there. And so it's like, and I work in a field where people are curious. And I was like, you know, if they really want to know my address, it's easily enough. But now I'm like going, okay, what am I going to do to like lock it down? Because I don't want to say cared that much in the past, but I also think that, like, you know, it's easy enough to find people. But I just had a case where someone sold a house. So I had their address and they sold a house, and it was like a month ago. And I'm sitting there going, okay, how long is it going to take the database to find the new address? Like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Like, how long is, and it's like, do I really know that they moved? Like, so, right. Yeah.
Yeah, and that happens too, because the hackers who are exploiting these data sets, yeah, they don't know for sure. They're not verifying it. There have been so many cases where swatting went wrong, where two gamers were playing a game and one person looked the other person up and sent the SWAT team at their home thinking they would disrupt their game or whatever by swatting them. And they ended up sending the SWAT team to someone else's house, a previous tenant. So they got their address wrong because the database wasn't updated. And that SWAT team ended up shooting the person dead, the other kid who was not even involved in this. So this was a big case. They went to jail and they kind of caught them. But yeah, this can happen all the time. You can be caught up in the wrong place at the wrong time through someone else's crime. So that's another concern. And there's many issues here at stake, but I think the core of this is privacy. And we need to take better care of what information is out there about us, and kind of scrub it slowly. It's a long-term process, but it needs to be done.
We also talked about stereotypes. So, okay, everyone, you can't see Michel, but he's got a hoodie on, but it's not on your head. So we've got these stereotypes about hackers. Like, I think of the girl with the dragon tattoo and Wasp. And Michel says he has not watched it, but I have this vision of all the characters. What are some stereotypes that you want to either break or validate?
Well, from a hacker's perspective, that's true. You know, the stereotype is they're always wearing a hoodie and stuff. And I play into that stereotype because people respond to it when I'm presenting. So as a public figure, when I'm educating and spreading awareness on how hackers hack, sure, I play into that stereotype. I'll wear jeans and hoodie and stuff. And it gets more attention. People are more attentive. They listen better. And also they're more comfortable versus if I wear a suit tie and start telling them about hacker and nerdy stuff. And they'll be like, yeah, it's more of a more to do with communication skills than anything else. But yeah, I wouldn't read too much into these stereotypes because they're mostly wrong. Like in the case of hacking and stuff, we always think it's, for example, a male who's hacking, who's in their teens or within like 20s or 30s at most. But a lot of these hackers are kids. They're like 13 or 19 year olds. And they may not even be male. They may be girls. Girls can be hackers too. So there's like a lot of these stereotypes kind of point to one direction. And we often say, oh, it's Russia or China or nation state. We always levitate to that first, when in most cases, it's someone local, some white Anglo-Saxon American sitting in their basement hacking because they were too bored, or they just had the ability to do it. They were just testing the waters out. So yeah, we need to get out of these stereotypes. They mean nothing. They're just there for distractions, and we need to focus on actually what's happening, how it happens, and prevention.
So this is funny. And you gave your presentation, and then there was a presentation afterwards, and it very stark differences of presentation. And I mean, I will let my bias, so it's like, okay, Michelle, he's in these rooms. He knows how to find anything. And the other person, which was much more, I'm going to say, buttoned up. And I'm like, so yeah, I do have a stereotype about that. And I'm sitting there going, can that guy really even turn on a computer? Does he know what a virtual machine is? And I know he does. Like, I mean, truly, I do know he does. But like, it's just that we have these stereotypes about that. And I mean, it's the same in my world. Is like, we just don't think women steal. And it's like, that's ridiculous. Totally ridiculous. Women are great at stealing. So
They're better social engineers, for one thing.
Yeah. Okay. When you say they're better social engineers, how, like, give an example.
So I took an entire course on social engineering. It was a week long practical course. There were guys and girls in that course. And the gist of social engineering there was to teach you social skills, go out in the public and get information from people, talk to them, get their full date of birth, get their home address and ask them where they're from. And, you know, little things like that. It was to kind of sharpen our skills in social engineering. That was part of the training. And we noticed that women were way better at getting information than men were, because people were very defensive. If a man walks up to even a man or a woman, they're like, yeah, what does he want? That's the first thing in their head. Whereas when a woman was walking up to either man or woman or child, there was really no hesitation. Like, they were like open and welcome to answer any questions. And the same thing was over the phone. A woman's voice was more pleasing over the phone. It was more like, yeah, she can't be a hacker. She can't have, it was like their preconceived notions. And, you know, whether, you know, somebody says, you know, whatever their opinions are, the fact of the matter is they had more of a success rate when it came to data exfiltration or elicitation of information. They were way better at that. Men may be better at maybe certain other things, maybe on the technical side, you know, hacking behind a computer and whatnot. But again, it could go both ways. But where I saw the main difference was, yeah, if it's the social engineer over the phone or in person, women had a much better chance of succeeding than men did.
Oh, can I take this class? Do they still offer it?
They do, yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm going to talk to you afterwards, and maybe I'll put it in the show notes, okay? Because that would be fun. I would love that.
Yeah, it was a very practical experience on how to do it. And not only did it teach us how to exploit humans, on how to get information from them that they wouldn't normally share, but also how to defend against this. So if somebody did the same techniques on me, I'd be like, huh, you know what? I took this class. I know what this is about. Maybe I should be a little bit more careful. One of the challenges was, like, if I'm talking to a kid as a grown man, if I'm talking to another father with their daughter next to them, I'd have a pretty hard time talking to them, because men are just considered whatever, pedophiles or whatever, because a pedophile's stereotype is a man. It can't be a woman, but even though women are and can be pedophiles. But if a woman did the same thing and said hi to a child, nobody would, you know, say anything. But if a man did that, it's a huge no-no. It's like, oh my God, what are you doing talking to a stranger kid and stuff like that. So we noticed these things, and we're like, yeah, it's much easier when a woman is around you. So when hackers hack in groups, it's usually the woman in the group that's like, all right, let me go and walk up to the front desk and get yourselves in, and then let the man do the, you know, something else. So there are roles within men and women when it comes to hacking, and we often overlook those and say, oh, a hacker is just a guy in a hoodie. It could be a girl in a dress too, so let's not oversimplify things.
Okay, so I just have this whole thing about like fraud and pop culture and like, you know, hacking in pop culture. Is there like a movie or a show that you are like, okay, they got it right? Or have you consulted? Because I get calls regularly from Hollywood about, can you consult on, you know, embezzlement? So what are your suggestions and or experiences with hacking in pop culture?
Well, first and foremost, I would say if you do get any other calls like that involve hacking, just forward those calls on to me. I'd love to consult. But there are very few movies or shows that I would say get it right or pretty accurate. One of them is Mr. Robot. Mr. Robot got it pretty well, the first season at least. They demonstrated a lot of hacking techniques, which in real life exist, and that's how hackers do. Sure, it was dramatized and sped up, but it was that at least the techniques were correct. Whereas in most movies, I would say 90% of it is just garbage. Somebody just banging on the keyboard with some Linux commands, and I'm like, this is not how hacking works. And you can't hack a bank in like 3 seconds. It takes months to do what they're doing. And like, I understand it's for a movie and it's for Hollywood, but yeah, I would say Mr. Robot was pretty accurate at that. And I would rather focus on, there's some Netflix documentaries and series about these things, about hacking, which are more docu-series. They're more real life than the actual movies. But yeah, I would love to consult and make better movie choices when it comes to hacking.
Ooh, interesting. Oh, I like that. Okay, if I get some, I will definitely refer them, because, you know, I'm one who can barely turn on my computer. No, that's not true. I am not a Luddite, but I'm nowhere close to you. So, okay, kind of closing up, what I want to have you give like a call to action to the audience of like, what is the best thing that we can do to protect ourselves? Like just anything that you're like, oh, this is just basic.
Yeah, I would say freeze your credits. That's something very basic, because when identity theft happens, they take your social security number and they try to apply wherever they can for credit, car loan or home or other disability loans. There's so many places to misuse it. So freeze all your credits. It takes a few minutes to do it. And when you need to use it, only you have the ability to unfreeze it. So I would say that's the core of identity theft. Use password managers and multi-factor authentication in everything. So everyone has hundreds of accounts online. Just, you know, make sure that you're using a password manager so you're not remembering passwords. Use something like Bitwarden, free and open source. And use multi-factor authentication wherever it's available. Even if it's sending you an SMS or using the Authenticator app. As a hacker, I can tell you that is, you know, the biggest defense you can take, because when hackers get your passwords, they log in and they cause havoc. But if they can't get to it, they can't breach your accounts because you have MFA on it. It makes it so much more difficult, and it makes them even more difficult if they can't get to step one, which is finding out what your email address looks like or what your phone number looks like, because you've taken care of your privacy. So I would say I dabble in the privacy world a lot, and I've created a website which is called operationprivacy.com, and I have all my tricks and techniques there in a nice little dashboard format where people can go checkbox at a time and say, all right, have I taken care of my home privacy? What about my online privacy? What about scrubbing from data brokers and credit freezes? So there's multiple categories I've created. So as you have time, I would recommend everyone to go there, do it yourself. It's a DIY website, free of charge, and it takes time. It's not going to take you a month. It's probably going to take you 6 months to take care of your privacy, but do it now before it's too late. Because when it is too late, once your information is all out there and someone's actively exploiting it and misusing it, then the cleanup becomes so much more difficult. So put in the hours today so that you're not struggling later on.
And I will link that in the show notes. And I'm gonna start. I'm motivated to like Yeah. And I'm going to the ATT.pentester.com now that we're, you know, finishing this up to check and see, because I don't remember when I had AT&T. I literally have no idea. I cannot thank you enough for this, because this is like, I mean, I love my podcast, but this is so actionable. Like this is, this whole podcast has been so incredibly actionable. And I hope to see you at future conferences that I have mentioned to you, because I think your message is so incredibly important, but also like in a good way and not in a scary way. You made it not in a scary way. And a lot of people are just scared of cyber, period. They're just scared. So...
Thank you very much for having me. It was my pleasure. And yeah, definitely we'll bump into the next con.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh. Yeah. So thank you.